Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey 1450, WCTC with the Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Hello, everybody, and good morning. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal. I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. And we're here to bring you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon. Check us out on restaurantguysradio.com or download our podcast on iTunes.
Hi, Mark.
Hey, Francis.
How are you?
I'm great.
It's that wonderful fungus time of the year again.
It is one of our favorite, well, kind of fungus.
Yeah. Well, actually, we're talking about truffles. Now, truffles are, for those of you who may not know, they're often classed in the mushroom family, and they're called a fungus. I understand, however, that truly the truffles are not a fungus. They're a tuber. They're an underground tuber. That's
like
what
a potato.
That's what I hear, but I don't know. I'm not exactly 100% certain on the pedigree of the truffle. But truffles are, they grow on the roots of a couple of different kinds of trees, like oak trees, and
we haven't really figured out how to plant them yet.
Well, they say though that there are more and more cultivated truffles, but it's a very rare market, and truffles are very, very expensive, sometimes up to $1,800 a pound. And what we have now are white truffles. This is white truffle season when you're in November, December. They come from, the white truffles come from Italy, primarily Piedmont. White truffles are little mushroom-like things that grow underground, and you shave them on top of food. You don't cook with white truffles, and it's a short season. It's about 2 months, and then in the beginning of next year we have black truffle season,
which you could cook with. You don't need to, but you could cook.
And black truffles come from France. So the way you use white truffles, and these things are very, very pricey.
Now again, Francis said as much as $1,800 a pound, but depending on the size of the truffle, depending on on the quality of the truffle, they can be $3,000, and if you have a giant truffle, as much as people spend as much as $40,000-$50,000 for a truffle.
Crazy.
Even for me.
People richer than me. however, the way these things work is very often we've traveled a lot in Europe and during truffle season, and even New York you see them more and more now than you have in the past. People will often, you can buy truffle by the gram. And
one of the things about truffles and why we're talking about it right now is truffles are highly perishable. So there's no such thing really as having fresh white truffles from anywhere in the world in June.
So when
there is no such thing as that.
You'll see truffles on the menu very often throughout the year. Truffle this, truffle that, truffle risotto. It's usually truffle oil or preserved truffles, truffles that have been put in a can. And while those things have merit,
and some of them are very good.
Much cheaper than a fresh truffle, and it's the same relationship that a fresh tomato in August has to a really good canned tomato. So there's a big difference there. So if you like the Jersey tomatoes in August, now is the time to go get a truffle. And the way that it's often done with white truffles, because they're shaved on top of things, is people will come over with a scale.
Hold, I have a question for you.
Yeah, shoot.
If you like Jersey tomatoes in August, how does that relate to now is the time to get a truffle?
Well, August is the season for tomatoes, now is the season for truffles.
Yeah, but I like truffles in truffle season, and I don't like tomatoes. Can I still get truffles now?
You know, you're being difficult. I think the listeners are smarter than you. Well, if you want a truffle, what they will often do is they'll come over to the table with the truffle in a container, and the formal way to have truffles shaved over is they'll place it on a scale, and in Europe we've gotten to some places that have these grandiose scales with the balance with the grams on them. In America you usually see a digital scale. but they take the truffle, they weigh the truffle, and then they take it and they'll shave it over your plate. Now be very careful when you're in a place like that.
If somebody's shaving truffles, one of the things that you need to do is tell them to stop when you have enough truffle.
Because if you go through, it's the cheapest we've seen is at San Domenico right now. It's $6 a gram. So you'd want about 5 grams
And remember, 454 grams in a pound. Okay.
Right.
So $6 a gram.
right.
You know, to get a tenth of a pound or an ounce and a half,
and
let's say,
and that's cheap.
You need 45 grams of truffle.
$6 a gram is kind of cheap. So you basically, on top of your risotto or whatever, you'd want 4 or 5 grams. You want to add about a $30-$40 supplement to your one plate.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, but I know we had one gluttonous friend, a guy named Bob. I know you know who he is.
I do.
He went to Europe and he had them shave an entire truffle. They had to go to a second one. He said it was like the snows of Kilimanjaro on a salad. The man bought a $400 salad.
Absolutely, a $400 salad, and that's what we're warning you to be careful in these places, because you could end up with a $400 salad.
Well, I mean, the thing is, Bob was quite a glutton. He actually had gout.
And he wanted a $400 salad.
And he did it on purpose. Don't you do it by accident.
But there are some cool places actually featuring truffles now.
You can go to San Domenico in New York on Central Park.
And by the way, I got some of this list of places from New York Magazine.
We'll link you to it. We'll put it up on our website. You can go to San Domenico on Central Park South.
Del Posto's got an incredibly looking... I haven't had the truffle tasting menu at $295 a person. That just looks off the charts.
Yeah, that's right. He said $295. But you can go to San Domenico and basically order truffles on anything that you like, and they'll shave it on for $6 a gram. So if you want to try it, you can go and have it shaved over a fried egg, you know, which is actually a really classic.
Yeah, my absolute favorite way to have white truffles, simple, shaved over a fried egg over polenta. The my absolute favorite way.
You can also go to Sapori Ishia, which is on 37th Avenue in Woodside. That's in Queens. And that's one of the best deals in town. I frankly don't understand how they do it. I view this with suspicion. But they serve a 4-course white truffle menu for $50. This I can't figure out. I mean, I don't know.
Either they're smuggling white truffles. No, I'm
something.
Just teasing.
I don't know.
I have no idea.
Okay, Mark and I are afraid of getting sued, so we can't say anymore. But
$50 for a white truffle menu is ridiculous.
But we may go to Queens to check it out, because if it's legit, it's really good. We're going to put that up on our website as well. And, of course, the Four Seasons. Oh, of course. We can go to the Four Seasons, and they have the...
$200 truffle tasting.
Yeah, but you know what? I don't know. I'm not coming there. I'm going to Del Posto. So I want to talk about Del Posto, because I was at the bar at Del Posto again, and that's Mario Batali's new flag. Well, his flagship, I guess, is Babbo, which is a sort of a new casual, like the most casual 3-star New York Times restaurant in New York. Del Posto is formal.
In the hot new meatpacking district, but super formal.
And I have to say, Del Posto, I think, is one of the best restaurants in Manhattan.
I love it. I've heard a lot of people criticize Del Posto that it's not attaining what it's reaching for.
I think they're stuffed shirts.
And I think they're stuffed shirts. I adore the place. I love the spaciousness of the tall ceiling.
I love the style of service.
I love the style of service. I love the food.
I love a huge white marble staircase in the middle of it. And I've been to the bar a couple of times now. Now, the meatpacking district is sort of an uber trendy, you know, place where people like look at themselves in the store windows as they walk by, and it's like fake to me. The meatpacking district, I don't even like to walk in the neighborhood. It's like I'm being on a set of a movie about trendy people. But Del Posto happens to be there, and it's a world apart. You walk into it, and this is what I think a grand restaurant should do. You walk into Del Posto, and you are in its own. It takes you into its environs. The world is shut out, and I go there for cocktails now, and you know, it's jacket and tie,
right?
But they're
you're right,
nice.
The moment the doors close behind you, you're transformed.
You're in Italy.
Into a new place.
And people are nice, and it's not intimidating at all. They're very, very friendly.
I was there one day. You say it's a formal atmosphere. I was there one day, and a woman was there with her stroller having a cocktail at the bar.
A very wealthy woman.
Yes, indeed.
Stroller. But the bar is really great. We recommend it. We're going to put all these places up. You can try the truffles in season, probably now through the end of the year. We'll put them up on our website, restaurantguysradio.com. We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:15. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurant in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. You know, we have a lot of stuff that comes across our desk. We had a press release that came across our desk recently that really struck both Mark and I, put it in each other's inbox, and so we were really struck by it. Let me read to you from it. The title is U.S. factory farms so bad they're a tourist attraction. Consumer Group brings European farmers to United States dairies. Dateline, Washington, D.C. Food and Water Watch welcomed farmers from France, Spain, and Germany this week for a first-hand look at the environmental and public health consequences of factory farm dairies in three states, Michigan, Oregon, and Washington. The quote is, U.S. factory dairy farms are so bad they're a tourist attraction, said Winona Howder, Food and Water Watch executive director. Well, we happened to call up Winona, and she was gracious enough to come on our show.
Winona, hello and welcome to the show.
Glad to be here.
So, Winona, our factory farm dairies are so bad we're bringing in people from other countries in sort of a cautionary tale of what could happen to them.
Are they fascinated?
They are fascinated and horrified. And, yes, dairy farmers in Europe are really fearful about what's going to happen to dairy in their countries. And so they were interested in coming to the U.S. to see what factory farming really looks like.
So there is no factory farming in Europe, or there historically hasn't been factory farming in Europe?
There's much less factory farming. There is some in countries like the Netherlands, some in Spain, but nothing on the scale like the U.S., where most of our food is produced in factory farms.
And what was the reaction of the Europeans who came over?
Well, they just couldn't believe it. You can imagine that farmers who have herds of under 100, how they would feel when they were at a farm. I don't know that you could even call this a farm, an industrial complex in Oregon.
My favorite term of art is the confinement animal feeding operation.
Yes.
That's more what it is all about. But anyway, yeah, so
55,000 dairy cows in one of these CAFOs, and it's out in the desert because these farms tend to be moving into places that don't have a lot of rain, because you can imagine how much waste there is with 55,000 cows.
I remember reading somewhere someone said that we have, in a very small area, we have the equivalent of multiples of, you know, the city of Seattle's natural raw sewage being dumped on our fields.
Yes, that's right.
Well, now, hasn't it always been the case that the way farms worked was the animal waste was used to fertilize the fields? What's different about confinement, you know, operations that where we get our food now?
Well, the difference is that when you run a smaller farm where you have different crops being grown and you have some animals there to produce food for your community, you have only a few animals, and so the waste is very beneficial. In fact, my husband runs our family farm. We have a community-supported agriculture program out in Virginia, and we have chickens and maybe as many as 5 pigs, and we use that waste, compost it, and then use it for fertilizer, and that is a wonderful system. It's a system that's been around for 10,000 years. When you have 55,000 cows and you have a lagoon where the waste goes into, it ends up polluting all of the water, the groundwater, and everything in the vicinity.
Well, so you're saying it's a matter of concentration. Like, it's just so unnatural, the earth can't absorb the waste of 55,000 cows.
That's exactly right.
Well, Winona, we talk to a lot of people about this subject itself, but I think a lot of our listeners are curious to hear. We have a lot of people that we need to feed. A lot of people are eating meat. A lot of people want to have cow. A lot of people want to have milk. Is there an alternative to these farms? I mean, don't we? I think that most of our listeners believe that what we need these large factory farms in order to feed all of our people.
Well, I think that's a mythology. The reason that we have this kind of consolidation and these huge factory farms is it's very profitable for the industry to have large-scale industrial complexes where they raise animals. We used to grow food much more locally, and we have that potential today. I mean, let's look just at the spinach crisis that we had in the last few weeks, where we see that all of the spinach, almost 100% of the spinach that we eat in the U.S. is grown in California, about 60% of it in the Salinas Valley. That means when you have some kind of contamination, you basically have no spinach available for the entire country. The same with dairy. The reason that we have dairy concentration isn't because it doesn't make sense to raise dairy cows more locally and to have dairy milk traveling just a few miles from where the consumers are, but because it's just more profitable to have these larger factory dairies. And so the policies, both the federal and state policies, have allowed consolidation and have driven this.
And, you know, what, just one of the things that Winona's talking about, I mean, if everyone would think for just a moment, what would have happened when we had a, you know, what happened recently is we had the E. coli problem with spinach. And so basically every piece of spinach in America, even our New Jersey local spinach, we didn't eat because so much spinach came from one place and we couldn't track it. Well, what happens in a system where you have a multitude of family farms and one of those farms get contaminated? Well, one little problem in one little county somewhere instead of a national crisis. Our guest is Winona Howder. She is with Food and Water Watch, and we'll be talking with her more in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 1125.
Floors, walls, and lighting. The Restaurant Guys learned long ago that the key to making a space look great are floors, walls, and lighting. There's no tougher test to a carpet than a busy restaurant. From design to installation to cleaning, the Gillespie Group has handled the Restaurant Guys restaurant floors for more than 10 years. Designers know what looks great on the first day. Bob Gillespie knows what will continue to look great year after year. Gillespie doesn't just install carpets. Their quality clean division has experience and expertise to keep that carpet looking great. In our business, it's the details that matter. In your home or office, the details make a lasting impression. The Gillespie Group handles projects from large hotels to offices right down to your living room. Look down. Go on, look down. Right there by your feet. You see. You need the Gillespie Group. Call them at 732-254-5508 or visit them at thegillespiegroup.com. Tell them the Restaurant Guys sent you and get a free cleaning with any installation. Remember, it's Gillespie for carpet and flooring, 732-254-5508.
Hey, everybody, welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Captain Lombardi Restaurant. Our guest today is Winona Howder. She is the executive director of Food and Water Watch, an environmental advocacy organization, which recently brought a group of European farmers to the United States to see how we farm our food. And they were, well, frightened and went back to Europe, weren't
they? It's all about being horrified.
So what did they learn from their trip here?
Well, we're working with them on in a global coalition regarding trade and the deregulation of agriculture. And so what they learned is that they're going to go back to the EU and that they're going to fight the proposals to institute the same type of policies there that we have here. They want to try and continue to have lots of their food grown regionally to protect the diversity of the type of food that's eaten in across Europe, and not to have one homogenized, industrialized food system that's similar to what we have here in the U.S.
Is there a way besides demand that we can get some of these laws turned back right side up and off of their head?
Well, I think so. I think that, for one thing, people are beginning to be fearful of eating some of the food that's produced in the global south, where some of the big corporations are moving their production to countries where they don't have as stringent environmental protections, where they can use very cheap labor, and where it actually doesn't even benefit the people there because they get pushed off their land and they can't feed themselves. And so I think people are beginning to be wary of that. I think we have an opportunity to change the production. We see that lots of people are growing are eating locally. They're getting their food from community-supported agriculture projects or from farmers' markets, and there is a new awareness. I think what we have to guard against is that we don't have a two-tier system, one for people who are educated and more affluent and can afford to buy organic food, even if it's industrial organic food from a Whole Foods market, and then all of those people who don't have the economic means or who aren't educated about the issues.
And after the news, we're going to talk more with Winona Howder of Food and Water Watch about that. I mean, and that is the paradigm of our age. You know, the healthy food for the rich people and the unhealthy food for the poor people seems to be a way that where we could go. And she and her organization have a lot of ideas as to how we can avoid that and how we can help the rest of the world from going down that wrong road. And we'll be right back after the news. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:30.
Central Jersey Talk Radio, Central Jersey, 1450. WCTC with The Restaurant Guys. Call them now at 732-545-9282. 732-545-9282.
Everybody, and welcome back. You are listening to The Restaurant Guys. I'm Mark Pascal, and I'm here with Francis Schott. Together, we own Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in New Brunswick, New Jersey. We're here to give you the inside track on food, wine, and the finer things in life. You can listen to us every day from 11 to noon, reach us through restaurantguysradio.com, or download our podcasts on iTunes.
Our guest today is Winona Howder. Her organization is called Food and Water Watch. They're an environmental advocacy organization and a darn effective one. You know, I made allusion before the news to a statistic, and I actually found it in my papers here while we were listening to the news, about what factory farmers and why, you know, a factory farmer producing manure is not like, you know, your family farm, which used the manure to fertilize the field. Here's a quote from Helen Redout, president of the Community Association for the Restoration of the Environment in Yakima County, Washington. And the quote is, in a 16-mile corridor, we have dairy operations dumping five times the amount of raw sewage as that produced by the entire population of Seattle onto our fields. So it's as if five Seattles came out and had a poo on your yard every day. And that's very different than having an outhouse in the backyard. Mm-hmm. And so I just want to give people an idea of the scale of what we're talking about.
Of some of these huge family farms.
Yeah, and look at a hog, because we know there are a lot of problems around pig production in the U.S., and one hog alone can excrete up to 17.5 pounds of manure and urine each day. So you have a factory farm that's say has 35,000 hogs, that's more than 4 million pounds of feces and urine produced each week. And so that's about 200 million pounds of waste each year from one farm.
Well, and you know, the thing about these factory farms is one of the reasons they're so cheap is they're able to offload the cost of doing business onto the rest of us. So if they ruin towns within 10 miles or 15 miles of the farm. You start a farm, if you live within 10 miles of a factory pig farm, when the wind changes direction, the value of your house goes down.
Right. Those people pay for that farm, or that factory, I should say, in the value of their home. Those people living
if they can't move, never mind the value of their home, with the health of their children. Mm-hmm. With the ability for their kids to play outside. I mean, did I get that right, Winona?
Absolutely. What happens in these rural communities where these factory farms move in is they promise a lot of jobs. They sweet-talk the policymakers, either the county board of supervisors or however the jurisdiction is legislated. And then they move in, and there is horrible air pollution. People get asthma. It smells so bad that real estate prices go down, and it just leads to more devastation of the rural community.
Do we have towns trying to get rid of some of these factory farms in their areas?
Yeah, we do. And there's a whole network of people who live in these communities who have become activists around the country who are fighting factory farms in their communities.
So people who weren't activists before but now are literally getting dumped on and need to become activists.
Right. These are not necessarily people who are Democrats or Republicans or even political. It brings people of different persuasions together to try to protect their community.
And I think that very often farmers in the Midwest or people in farm communities, until this happens in their community, are hoodwinked into voting against their own self-interest. But boy, when a factory farm moves in, you know what happens. And here, by the way, is the paradigm. Working class people, okay, who are usually, or very often in the Midwest especially, heavily indebted, right? And so you own,
the bank owns 90% of your house, right? Your mortgage isn't paid off completely. So
that actually sounds kind of familiar, Francis.
It's true. But you're out in the Midwest, and you've got all, your largest asset is your home. The bank, you know, maybe it's a $125,000 home. You've got a $110,000 mortgage on your home. Factory Farm moves in. Well, now your house is worth $70,000. You can't move. It's not possible to move. You have to stay there, and you can't open your windows, and your kids aren't healthy. So this is, I mean, we're talking about factory farms that will have piles of manure, huge piles of manure, that will catch flame, catch fire, and burn for months. That's not natural.
Yeah, and what happens in these communities is that it has a snowball effect, so that then small family farms go out of business. They can't patronize the local businesses. The factory farms operate with minimal labor, and they purchase their building materials and supplies elsewhere. So you end up not having any benefit for the community.
Well, no, that's not a snowball.
Yeah, exactly. So, well, and just so you know where we are in this country, and Europe's not there yet, and they're considering where to go, and these huge corporations are trying to get Europe to go in the same direction, but hopefully they'll view what happened here as a cautionary tale, and hopefully we'll band together and do something about it. Right now, more than half of United States livestock is produced on 5% of the farms, okay? That's very, very frightening.
Well, it's frightening on so many levels. You know, This little spinach flare that went up for all of us, I hope that we see the light from the flare of this little spinach
incident.
If
you had a diverse production of spinach, if spinach were still produced in, you know, 10 states, and we, by the way, we do have local spinach produced here in New Jersey that came into season right
after
the scare.
Which we used. That was fortunate.
Well, we used, but we didn't use half as much of it because our customers all said, no spinach. So
I'm sorry, I used in my house.
Right, but the local spinach crop was depressed. The local New Jersey spinach farmers were hurt by this. Because it's all one big system, and we don't think, oh, you know what? There was a farm in California that got some E. coli on their spinach.
But I live in New Jersey, so
right.
Who cares?
Exactly. So, I mean, I think that provides a real problem, another economic problem for us as consumers. Now, Winona, your group is Food and Water Watch. Let's talk about water. One of the things that I keep hearing about that scares the tar out of me is there is a move throughout the world to try and privatize control of water.
That's exactly right. Here in the U.S., about 85% of our water is public, although three large European companies came in with the idea of privatizing a lot more of our water. And actually, New Jersey is one of the states that has quite a bit of privatized water. One of the companies from France, Suez, owns United Water, and they operate in New Jersey. And usually the cost for the water is higher. They also have a very bad parts of the world with not building the infrastructure that they agreed to build, with raising tariffs, and also with not being accountable, not giving good customer service.
Well, how do they own the water? How does water become privatized? Because water is life itself.
Well, there are different ways that water is being privatized. What I've just been speaking about is the municipal type of privatization, where they come in and they get a long-term contract, often for about 30 years, to run the water system. And the politicians in the community go along with this because they often have not made sure that the infrastructure repairs are made. And so it's a short-term solution during when they're in holding office, that they don't have to deal with the water. They also often get campaign contributions.
It's a quick cash flow fix that looks good on the books for 1 year.
Yeah, exactly.
But
and so they come in, they have this contract, and then they can't meet the terms of the contract. We've seen this over and over again here in the U.S. The same United Water I mentioned in New Jersey got kicked out of Atlanta. They had boil water days. Brown water, they made a complete disaster, and that had been the largest privatization in the U.S. So
that's what we really want. We really want to have boil water days.
Yeah,
sorry,
absolutely.
Today is a day you'll be boiling water. Well, the other thing that I think a lot of people don't realize when you talk about water, that your skin actually absorbs a lot of water when you take a shower, when you bathe. And that your body absorbs a lot of those things that are in the water just by bathing it. You don't necessarily have to drink it.
Yeah, that's right. Well, that's, I guess, a related scam, though, is bottled water. And, I mean, that's another way that water is being privatized, is that rather than making the investment in public water and having good and healthy water that's properly filtered and using the most modern equipment, there's a tendency to purchase bottled water. And bottled water is almost completely unregulated in the U.S., and there have been any number of tests done, and often bottled water has bacterial contamination, toxic heavy metals.
All right.
It's very problematic.
If you're not scared yet, come back in just a moment. We'll talk.
We can scare you. We can scare you more in the next segment.
Even more. We'll be talking about water and the fishies that live in it in just a moment with Winona Howder. She is Executive Director of Food and Water Watch, and she's watching our food and water, and you should too. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:45.
Let me talk to you about lighting, and specifically about how you can enhance the appeal of any space. Lighting is a powerful, emotional, and aesthetic force. It's one of the most important elements of design. More than anything else, it sets the mood and tone for an entire experience. A room pops or it doesn't, based on lighting. Lights on 9 is a top-notch commercial and retail lighting supplier. Lights on 9 supplied all the lights for our award-winning Catherine Lombardi restaurant, inside and out, dining room and kitchen. Lights on 9 has everything from tasteful and stylish chandeliers to table and floor lamps to outdoor lighting for illuminating a building or walkway or a sign. At Lights on 9, the service is exemplary, expert, and knowledgeable. They ship anywhere in the continental United States for free. Their retail store is in the Galleria Shopping Center on Route 9 in Manalapan. They're open 7 days a week. Call them at 732-308-9166. That's 732-308-9166. Or visit them at lightson9.com. That's lightson9.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys. Mark and Francis of Stage Left and Catherine Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick, New Jersey. Our guest today is Winona Howder. She is Executive Director of the Environmental Advocacy Group Food and Water Watch. Winona, we were talking about privatization of water, and I do think that there are issues that arise with this sort of fascination of bottled water. But what's more disturbing to me is there are places in the world where the water supply, I mean the basic water you need to get a drink, is being largely controlled, turned over to private interests. And, you know, when a private interest owns something that you need to live like that, that's a very unprecedented thing. Is it possible, or are there places in the world where private companies control access to, you know, not the bottled water that you buy as a luxury, but at the basic water that you need to live?
That is happening. There is a trend around the world to privatize municipal water supplies, and it's happened in Asia, Africa, Latin America, and in part, this is because the World Bank has been promoting this type of privatization. And it means that poor people basically don't have access to water. We did an analysis of World Bank loans and found that around 94% required countries to privatize water in order to get a bank loan and to charge a user fee. And we're talking about countries where people make an average of $1 or $2 a day. So this is pretty outrageous. And then when the privatization occurs, we've seen nothing but bad service, inability to connect more people to get water. The connections usually go to the affluent neighborhoods where hotels are going in or resorts. And it basically is not providing people with access to water.
So now, am I just smarter than the people who are making these decisions, or does this seem like a really
You're
bad
certainly
idea?
Poorer than the people making decisions.
Yes, I think that's the key. You're poorer. I think this is all about making money, and the World Bank often looks after the interests of corporations before it looks after the interests of the world's poor. And so these water companies have come in. They see that water is a threatened resource. We're diverting, damming, and polluting water, and it's going to be a profit center in the future if they have their way. And so they're figuring out different ways to gain access and control, buying aquifers, trying to control rivers, building dams.
But isn't this a fundamental political change? Because, you know, food takes work to make. You always had to buy food. You always had to buy from the farmer. You always had to buy from the hunter. And food has always been controlled. But it's my impression of history that in most cultures and in most places, the water, even at Roman times, was considered a public good. That water was so... I mean, you can last a couple of days without food. You can't last a couple of days without water.
Yeah, the Australians had a rebellion when you tried to manage their rum.
Yeah.
What do you think's going to happen? What do you think's going to happen when manage their water?
Is this a fundamental change to say that the water belongs to you, and if anybody else wants water, they need to buy it from you? The public water fountain, the Roman aquifer, hasn't water always been in our culture a public commodity?
In civilization, our culture.
I think that's true around the world. And that's why there's been such a public uprising against this kind of privatization, where people just won't stand for it. I think it's going to be very difficult for corporations to really come in and control water for the long term, because it leads to political upheavals. But in the shorter term, it is meaning that poor people don't have access to water. And there is a movement to start to get a treaty, a UN treaty, that protects the right to water. And interestingly enough, the U.S. has been one of the countries refusing to say that there is a right to water, and actually taking actions at the UN against having any right to water language.
And you know, there's another thing that people, when I have this discussion with people, that people bring up. Yes, water rights have always been an issue, but we're talking about the water to run your farm, the water to run your factory, the right to dam up water, the right to stop the flow of a river, water for commerce in those ways. But here the fundamental change is we're talking about water to drink. And water to drink has always been, you know, if someone's thirsty, you give them water. That's how it works, you know? I mean, that's basic human interaction, more basic than food even. And this is under threat, and it's very, very scary.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And that's why I think even here in the U.S., where most things are privatized and people think the private sector does a better job, that when these private water companies come into the community, that there's a bipartisan organizing that takes place around the privatization.
You mean against it?
Against it.
Yeah, it's just something that I don't want somebody making money off of.
Well, and the other thing is, if you want to say I'm going to hire a company to administer the waterworks for a set time, not 30 years, that's fine. But when you, as in many countries is happening now, and as many places saying, okay, you now you own what comes into the aquifer, you own the water itself, and we'll buy it back from you. That is very, very scary, and I think a fundamental change.
Yeah, I don't want to be panning for rain.
Yeah, exactly. Winona, we have to leave it there for now, but I want to thank you for coming on the show. How do people get in touch with your organization? What's your website?
Our website is foodandwaterwatch.org.
And if you want to educate yourself about that and you forget that, you can go to restaurantguysradio.com. We're going to put up a link. It's a tremendous organization. There's a tremendous amount of information on their website. And you can go educate yourself while you have a great meal in our restaurant.
Thanks, Winona.
Thank you.
We'll be back in just a moment. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450. The time is 11:55. Hello, everybody, and welcome back. You're listening to The Restaurant Guys, Mark and Francis, Steve Lux, and Captain Lombardi Restaurants in downtown New Brunswick.
You know, yeah. You know, we were talking about a lot about the water supply and things like that, and last night we had some folks visit us from Australia, came listeners to the show and came to the restaurants last night. Joe and Ken came in to see what we do in the restaurants.
And that's right. They came from Australia because they listened to the show. I'm still sort of amazed by that.
Well, one of the things that I was talking to them about was the Australian water issues that they have. And what's happened in Australia is a lot of these farms and a lot of these areas, they're having exactly some of the same problems we are with kind of agribusiness and large factory farms kind of taking over their countryside. And so they've had now 5 continuous years of drought because a lot of the water's been diverted to irrigate places that probably shouldn't be irrigated in order to be growing food.
You can grow crops in the desert, but then the city has to starve, has to dry out.
And that's pretty much what's going on. The water's so hot. One of the things they said is some of these rivers that are being diverted to bring water to certain areas, lose 75% of their water to evaporation before they actually reach the places that they're supposed to irrigate.
Right.
So they're losing all of this water to evaporation because they're trying to carry the water to places that it really shouldn't go.
Yeah.
And at the same time, they said, you know, if you fly over, you can just look at the patches of green where you can see this water is being diverted to in the middle of all this barren wasteland.
Desert. Yeah, you can make water flow in the desert, but
and it's just not a good idea. We're not doing the right thing.
There's a cost to everything. Do you know what I was upset about?
Mm-hmm.
They had emailed us from Australia that they wanted to come in to dinner and they were going to be in, and I was like, all right, that's cool. And they said, hey, we listen to your show all the time. Do you want us to bring you anything that you can't get there?
Oh, yeah.
And I wanted them to bring me some Vegemite.
Because we've heard so much about it.
Only from the Men at Work song.
That's right.
They brought me Vegemite, but the customs seized it at L.A.
In L.A., Vegemite is illegal in the United States, we have since learned.
They come from a land down under, where women go and men chunder.
They don't plunder?
I don't know anything about Australia. All I know about is Australian wine, and they bought us a great bottle of Australian wine, too.
Very nice.
We're going to drink the bottle of Australian wine they brought us on New Year's Eve with Jackie Naylor after the concert at Stage Left and Catherine Labarde.
It's going to be great.
And if you want to go to that, go to stageleft.com or catherinelabarde.com, and you can find out what we're doing on New Year's big gala jazz concert, New Year's Eve celebration. It's going to be a lot of fun. Hope you've enjoyed the hour with the Restaurant Guys. I'm Francis Schott.
And I'm Mark Pascal.
We are the Restaurant Guys, Central Jersey, 1450 times 12 noon.